We would all like to live there, wouldn't we? We'd all like to live in that society, that culture, that world, where the problems that we face every day and the problems we face collectively just weren't there, where we could eliminate things like poverty, disease, war, famine. We could, for that matter, eliminate bad weather. It would be the best of all possible worlds, wouldn't it? It seems to be a dream built into the human psyche that we can somehow achieve this. There have been many attempts and many failures, but everyone seems to have deep in their hearts an idea of utopia. We're going to talk about utopianism, pantheism, and tolerance in the first hour of Issues Etc. today. Professor Alan Quist joins us as our first guest for the first hour. In the second hour of the program, we'll talk for about 25 minutes with Dr. David Reardon about the psychiatric effects of abortion on women. He's director of the Elliott Institute. We'll follow that with an hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. Two things out of the paper that caught my eye today. One is Marshall Faulk walking out of the courtroom. There he is, looking rather somber, actually. The charges against him were proven false, and he was awarded $125, the cost of filing the suit in the county. The charges were brought by a former girlfriend, but she also happens to be, and this is what caught my eye. My wife and I were actually talking about this the other night. I said, did you hear about Marshall Faulk? Yeah, and then she said, what is that, his ex-wife? No, that's his ex-girlfriend and mother of three of his kids. Apparently, he is very generous with his money. But what I'm wondering is, this is one of the Rams, for heaven's sake. This isn't just one of the Rams. This is about 90% of the team, if you actually get down to it, in most games when he's feeling good. And yet he's got three kids out of wedlock. We'll talk a little bit about that. There's some stories and some columns in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch I'll share with you in that regard. Also, you saw it, Right to Carry, promising to sign concealed weapon legislation, carried Bush into the Texas governor's chair. Holden's refusal to sign it could mean one term and out for him. We're going to talk about the right to carry and gun control in that hour of open lines from 4:30 to 5:30. In the final half hour of the program, our good friend Wesley Smith from the Discovery Institute will join us. He's author of a recent column in the Weekly Standard titled New Name, Same Old Story. We'll talk about the new image that the Hemlock Society is trying to craft for itself. Our phone numbers for these 3 hours of Issues Etc., feel free to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're going to talk about utopianism and pantheism and tolerance in the first hour of the program. Professor Alan Quist is our guest, professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. Professor Quist will be making a presentation at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar. You've heard about this. I've been talking about it. In fact, I'm going to be there along with my producer broadcasting live during part of this from June 20 through the 27th at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat Center and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. I'll tell you a little bit more about that seminar a little bit later. His presentation at the seminar is titled Indoctrination in Utopianism, Pantheism, and Tolerance. Professor Quist, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, Todd, thank you for having me on your show. If you hear any noise in the background, I'm sitting right now under a pretty aggressive thunderstorm. In fact, there's a crack of thunder now.
I heard it.
There's a fair amount of hail, and the deck that I'm watching here is now pretty white, and we also have a tornado warning. So anyway, if the line goes dead here, just go on with the show, because I'm probably in the basement, but
well,
I don't anticipate that.
If the line goes dead, or if you have to scurry to the basement, your safety comes first, but we'll reconnect with you.
Okay.
All right. Let's begin with the overall idea of utopianism. I said there in the introduction that this seems to be a notion, a world free of poverty, war, and all the other maladies that afflict us, not only corporately as a society, but individually. seems to be somehow built into our psyche that we can achieve this somehow. What is this utopian impulse?
Yeah. Todd, I think you're absolutely correct that it does seem to be built into our psyche. At least it certainly keeps showing up in the various cultures that have appeared in the world. And I suppose in the last 50 to 100 years, the best known utopian vision was that of Karl Marx, which we know today, of course, as communism. And we have to keep in mind that the way communism actually came to be known, as in Russia and probably also in communist China, was really quite different from the utopian dream that Karl Marx had. Because what Karl Marx said was that if we eliminated the division between the rich and the poor, he said the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, and so everyone had the same status, the same economic status, then he said we would have a utopian society, and he said we would all work according to our ability and contribute according to our need. And in fact, Karl Marx said that government would cease to exist because government would be unnecessary. There wouldn't be any crime. There wouldn't be any poverty. Everybody would simply share with one another, and we would have a utopian society. So that's probably the best known, fairly recent, and very, very prevalent example of utopianism, although, and this is part of the message that I bring to our country, the Karl Marx view of utopianism really has been replaced by a new view of utopianism that is followed at least as widely, maybe even more widely, than the Marxist view was, and that in a nutshell is the notion of creating a one world global government, or a one world government, if you will, also called a world federalism. And there is a very aggressive worldwide federalist society and others outside that are very actively working to adopt this one world government structure. And they paint that along lines that are really pretty similar to what Karl Marx said. They don't say that government would cease to exist, but you can hear the violin music playing in the background when they describe their dream, and it's the whole notion of the lion will lay down with the lamb and everything will be wonderful. So that's the new form of the utopian dream in our world and in our country.
Well, there is this impulse in virtually every society that history has taken note of toward utopianism, a dream. I mean, even the early Greeks, I'm thinking about Plato's Republic. He is writing about a world that if it worked the way he said it would work, it would be a utopia for all intents and purposes. And yet at the same time, there has always been a wariness about this impulse. I'm thinking, you were talking about communism. I'm thinking about George Orwell's thinly veiled prognostications about communism in 1984. He saw how bad it could actually get, and he was right.
He was absolutely right. And at the same time, as you point out, there is this within the human psyche, maybe within the human spirit, this longing for and often a false notion of some kind of heaven on earth. And I'm convinced that what really is at the bottom level here is a fundamental rebellion against God himself, who has made it very clear in his word that as long as we live here on earth and as long as human life continues, there will be war, there will be poverty, there will be disease, there will be strife, because these things are ingrained in the human heart, in the human psyche, in the human being. And so the utopians want to deny the original sin or the evil that is inside people, and they always attribute the evil in the world to something outside of human beings. Economic conditions like Karl Marx, or many of the liberals too, you know, talk about poverty being the cause of crime and all of that. And the radicals don't want to admit that it's the human heart that is the source of the evil. And the Bible makes it very clear there's not going to be a utopia until the Lord comes again and all his people are gathered to him and we are transformed into new people. But there will not be a utopia here on earth.
This is making me think about what I, for lack of a better term, would call religious utopianism. Of course, we're witnessing worldwide Islam seems to, in some places, have a utopian impulse behind it as well. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that's true with all of the false religions, that there are utopian impulses. And for instance, you can read to the New Age religion, and I'm thinking especially of Joseph Campbell, who's probably the best known of the writers of the New Age theologians. And Joe Campbell always has a utopian flavor about what he says. In that we are one with nature, and there's peace and harmony and togetherness, and the strife is gone, and the war with nature is gone. We're one with nature. And whenever you have the rejection of what God says, you get these utopian ideas.
So the basic idea seems to be here, and the path that man always seems to take in driving toward utopianism is, if I can remove all external causes, which are the real reasons behind evils and troubles in the world, if I can remove those external causes, then I and my fellow man, we will be free to be our better selves, and a utopia will result.
That's exactly right. And so a lot of us refer to this with the term the perfectibility of human nature, or the perfectibility of human beings. Either through better education or different economic conditions or different government conditions, that human beings develop into much nicer, kinder, gentler kind of people. And of course, if we understand original sin, we know that that's not going to happen. And if we simply look at the history of the world, it's pretty clear that the history of the world is a history that continues to have war, continues to have all kinds of strife, continues to have poverty, continues to have disease. And if a person were strictly rational about it, the person would say, well, it looks like things are continuing always as they have. So you have to make a irrational leap when you take the position that human nature is perfectible. But it is that religious leap that, in fact, is taken by many of, I would say, the radicals, not so much the left, but the radicals.
Is there, in some quarters, a brand of Christian utopianism that says, look, man is not perfectible, but Christians, if they were in charge, could bring about a utopia, either by force or by proselytization or whatever it is?
Well, I think there is, there is always a danger that people want the church to be running the government. And you mentioned before Islam, Todd, and of course this is part of the Islamic belief that the religious leaders should be running the government. And in fact, that's what some of the Shiites in Iraq want to do. But Christian people, if we're good on theology, have always recognized that there are two kingdoms, not just one, and the two kingdoms are the kingdom of the church and the kingdom of the state. And the kingdom of the church has one role, and that's to preach the good news of Christ. And the kingdom of the state has one role, and that's to protect the innocent and the vulnerable. But there are two different kingdoms. They aren't totally separate, but there are two kingdoms, and God himself is the king and king of both kingdoms, but they're still separate.
Our guest is Professor Alan Quist. He's professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. He will be making a presentation at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June the 20th through the 27th at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. This conference is something I'm going to be attending at least a couple days, but we'll be broadcasting live from there, and we'll be talking with some of the speakers at the seminar, including Professor Alan Quist. Other speakers include Angus Manouge. These are all Issues Etc. regular guests. Dr. Craig Parton. And let's see, George Mather is there, and also Pastor Ralph Preuss. I might be leaving one or two out. And the subjects covered are all under the umbrella of a confessional Christian worldview. Now, the conference is the 20th through the 27th of June at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat Center in Trago, Wisconsin. That's about 2 hours north of Minnesota. I'm sorry, Minneapolis. I don't want to go north of Minnesota, I guarantee you. No farther north than that. And it's about 2 hours north of Minneapolis. The cost of the entire seminar, including the seminar, 7 days lodging, and 19 meals, is $229. If you want more information, you can visit our website, issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org, or you can call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848. Alan, you talked about this before. Let's go into this deeper. And I think we need to tread lightly here, because there are an awful lot of conspiracy theories, both Christian and secular, that listening to this would say, ah, now we're really talking about the good stuff. You mentioned a one-world government. Where can we find an example of this in our everyday life, of something like an indoctrination into the utopia of a one-world government?
Well, let me point your listeners, Todd, to two things. First, let me quote a very influential individual in the United Nations, and that's an individual by the name of Morris Strong. And Morris Strong, over the last 25 years, has probably, arguably, had more influence in the UN than anyone else. He's been Assistant Secretary General to several different Secretaries General. He was head of the very famous Earth Summit back in 1992. He now is head of all the non-governmental organizations that work with the UN, and I could give you a page or two of all of his activities. But anyway, Morris Strong, when he addressed the assembly at the famous Earth Summit in 1992, began by saying this, and I quote, Morris Strong, "The concept of national sovereignty has been," notice the past tense, by the way, "an immutable, indeed sacred principle of international relations. It is a principle which will yield only slowly and reluctantly to the new imperatives of global environmental cooperation. It is simply not feasible for sovereignty to be exercised unilaterally by individual nation states. The global community must be assured now of environmental security." And so what Morris Strong said to the assembly back in 1992 is that national sovereignty, and that means the independence of the United States of America, is history, and that in order to really protect the globe, we have to all get together in a one-world global governmental community. Morris Strong is arguably one of the five most powerful people in the world. Some would say he is the most powerful person in the world. So this isn't conspiracy theory insofar as this being some kind of backdoor business. I mean, this is out in the open for anybody that is willing to see what's there. Now, that's at the international level. Let me become very, very local. There is a widely used textbook in government in American schools, and it's called We the People, the Citizen and the Constitution. And this particular textbook was funded by our tax dollars, both in 1994, and then the new education bill, which is called H.R. 6, refunded this textbook. This particular textbook, called We the People, the Citizen and the Constitution, by the way, Todd, many Christian schools use this textbook, not just public schools. This particular textbook never, so all un-American government, never once mentions national sovereignty. It doesn't exist. And if we had time, I could go through some of the tables and some of the areas where the textbook should talk about national sovereignty. It is absolutely out of sight, out of mind. Well, what does it advocate instead? Well, when you get towards the end of the textbook, it has a chapter that is called, and I quote, "How may citizenship change in the nation's third century?" So immediately I have the question, well, citizenship, now we're citizens of the United States, so if we're talking about changing that, we're going to become citizens of something else. Well, what is that something else? Well, let me read just a little bit of what that something else is, and I quote from this textbook. Quote, "The achievements of modern technology are turning the world into a global village." Global village, that's code language, world federalism, one world government. What else does it say? It says the issues confronting American citizens are increasingly international. It says the culture we live in is becoming increasingly cosmopolitan, that is, belonging to the whole world. So you see the whole global idea. And then the textbook ends with this question. This chapter ends with this question. Do you think that world citizenship will be possible in your lifetime. World citizenship instead of U.S. citizenship, world citizenship is one world government. Now, to test out my interpretation of this chapter in the American government class, which I teach in the fall, I photocopied this chapter. I brought it into class one morning. I gave every student a copy of the chapter, and this is what I said. I said, I want you to interpret for me what this textbook is saying, and we're going to choose here a moderator, and I'm going to leave, and I want you to decide what this chapter is saying, and then when you've got your decision, I'm going to be right outside the door. You just send somebody out and bring me back in. So I went outside the door. 10 minutes later, one of the students came out, and he said, Your Honor, we have reached a verdict. And I said, okay. And I went back in. I went to the front of the class, and I said, okay, you tell me, what does this chapter say? And the class all together said, this is advocacy of one world government. I said, are you sure? They said, yes. I said, do you have any questions? They said, no. Do you have any reservations? None whatsoever. And so that's the agenda. And so what's going on is that you have the international agenda as being championed by Maurice Strong and the UN being incorporated into textbooks like this. And this textbook is written at taxpayer expense. And so a school can buy this textbook for $10 a piece. The textbook that I use, my students pay $67 a piece for. But because this is subsidized and authorized by our tax money, you can buy it very, very cheaply. And this is the part of the curriculum that is being imposed by the federal government under No Child Left Behind, the new education bill, and it originally was imposed back in 1994 under School to Work, Goals 2000, and that whole education agenda. And so the one-worlders have succeeded in getting their utopian dream by force of law incorporated into many, probably most of the textbooks in government, in our country, and as we speak, it is being taught to the children of our country.
What we've only got about 30 seconds here before we go to a break. What grade level is that textbook written to?
This is a high school level textbook, and so it's probably taught most of the time in the junior year, but it could be taught any time at the high school level. They also have a middle school textbook, and the agenda of that's the same. It's just I'm not quoting from that. It's not quite as explicit.
Our guest is Professor Alan Quist. We're talking about utopianism, pantheism, and tolerance. We'll get into those other things after this break. You know, when Marshall McLuhan first coined the term global village, he was talking about the fact that communication had become global, that we were able to see events and witness events, if you can call it witnessing events, in real time from all over the world. I do not think he was advocating what is now meant by global village. I do not think he was advocating or could even anticipate what was becoming of the term that he had coined, global village. When we come back, if someone who desires a one-world government thinks this is the best of all possible worlds, the utopia, if you will, if they argue against national sovereignty, then how can they turn around and argue for global sovereignty? We'll talk about that right after this break. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Can we find a path to God through mysticism, moralism, and speculation? And what were the beliefs, teachings, and practices of the first evangelicals? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House, their phone number 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. The Spirituality of the Cross is written by Dr. Jean Edward Veith, culture editor for World Magazine. In this book, Dr. Veith details his journey through a variety of religious experiences and frustrations. The cost is $8.99 plus shipping and handling. The Spirituality of the Cross, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this global minute invites you to do something unique. Pray for a group of people called the Saman. They live in northeastern China, and there's only a few thousand people who can claim Saman ancestry. Spearfishing is a unique talent that's important to the Saman in China. The Global Prayer Digest magazine reports there are 3,000 of them, and some are atheists, while others worship spirits and rely on a shaman, a spiritual leader, to guide them. Ancestor worship is a common practice among them, and almost every home has an ancestor tablet hanging prominently so family members and visitors can easily see it. There's no known Christian church, and few of them have heard about Jesus Christ. Tourists from inside China and foreigners travel through the area to see the local Saman villages and take part in their religious dances. Pray that Christians will make the trip and introduce the people to Christ's love. Pray for spiritual needs around the world by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The New York Times, all the news fit to print, is now cleaning up the mess created by former reporter Jason Blair. Blair was fired for fabricating news stories. Back in 1800, the editor of the New London, Connecticut Bee advertised this about his paper: "Here, various news we tell of love and strife, of peace and war, health, sickness, death, and life, of old mismanagements, taxations new, all neither wholly false nor wholly true." Can you believe what you read? A friend of mine down at the gas station likes to say, "Dale, when the big guy calls me, I'm going to tell him I'm a friend of yours." To which I say, "You know, that won't be your normal audit. H&R Block won't go with you. You have to appear on your own." Which is why I'm convinced a thinking person will be driven to read as much news as possible, and the Bible too. We are responsible for knowing the truth, and one day you and I will be called to answer for it.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about utopianism, pantheism, and tolerance during this first hour of the program with Professor Alan Quist, Professor of Political Science at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about defending the biblical worldview with Craig Parton of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Craig Parton will be one of the speakers at this Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June 20th through the 27th in Trago, Wisconsin. I'll tell you a little bit more about that near the end of the hour. Also tomorrow, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross. We'll be talking about the theology of the cross with him tomorrow on Issues Etc. Alan, you quoted Morris Strong, who has long credentials in the United Nations organization, talking about new imperatives and how individual nation states cannot continue to work under a concept of national sovereignty. If he argues against individual states exercising national sovereignty, how can he turn around and in the same breath argue for what amounts to global sovereignty of a global government?
Mm-hmm. Well, the way that the World Federalists usually describe this, and I'm going to refer to a well-known writer, speaker, thinker, and so on by the name of Amitai Edzioni, who 2 years ago was the keynote speaker at the Nobel Symposium here at Gustavus Adolphus College. They had a symposium 2 years ago on globalism, and Amitai Edzioni was the keynote speaker. And what Edzioni said was this. He said that just as the states here in the United States or 200 years ago came together to form a federal government. So the next step in evolution, and see, evolutionary thinking is a big part of this, the next step in the evolution of government is now for the nations to come together and form a world federalism. So by analogy, it's doing around the world what we did as a country 200 years ago, and with the evolutionary thinking, we go to higher levels of governing processes. We now come to this pinnacle of progress using the evolutionary scheme of things. So that's the way they see it. They also see it in terms of, you know, here, some of their arguments are that because the environmental concerns are global, that is, we're dealing with the atmosphere, which is global, we're dealing with worldwide water systems, we're dealing with global warming, which many of us are convinced is totally unproven, by the way. But because the environmental issues are global, the solutions have to be global. And if you're going to have global solutions, you have to have global governance. Another of the arguments that the World Federalists use is this, that right now it's very, very difficult to tax multinational corporations, because if you put a high tax on a corporation, let's say in the United States, that corporation says, well, okay, we'll just move our operations to Bangkok or to Brazil. And so it's very difficult to tax the corporations. But if you had a world government with a tax system, there would be no places for the big corporations to hide, so to speak, and we could really go after them and get their money, and they wouldn't be able to dodge us by moving to another country. So those are some of the common arguments that the World Federalists use.
So they don't really argue in favor of national sovereignty per se. They argue for the need for national global sovereignty.
Well, they do. And part of it, too, is there is the religious aspect to it, and this is also especially true with Morris Strong and his wife, Hannah Strong. They have a ranch in Colorado. It's called Baca Grande, and it is a center for New Age and occultist religious meetings, practices, gatherings, activities, and things like that. And so just think of the New Age mentality, and again, as Joseph Campbell describes it, where the real truth are those common things to all religions, the way Campbell puts it. And so the real truth then politically is what's common to all countries and what's common to all cultures. And so you have a common religion, which is the New Age religion, just as you have a common government, common culture, common education system. This is part of the plan. Where you have international skill certificates where people can travel all over the world and be hired, as a plumber or whatever. And so it's part of this whole globalist worldview, and it's really remarkably consistent, very persuasive, and it is a utopian dream.
I'm a little conflicted on this because I do see a certain utility to having what amounts to international cooperation on a lot of things, because there are certainly countries that can't do anything for themselves, that's true. But I'm also deeply concerned because this sounds like boilerplate utopianism. Let's talk about some of the aspects that you've mentioned here just a bit. One of them being environmentalism, but the first one I would like to deal with is multiculturalism. Is this a one-world culture as well?
That's the goal, to achieve a one-world culture. That's correct. And the notion is that you have your different cultures that maintain a separate identity, but what you have then is you have the agreement that, well, since all the cultures are equal, except, of course, American culture, and since all the religions are equal, except, of course, Christianity, we might as well all get together and kind of share power and share influence and share everything with one another. And multiculturalism is, in fact, a fundamental building block, just as environmentalism is. It's a fundamental building block to this one-world way of thinking.
What about the environmental concerns? I mean, someone would say, look, we do share an atmosphere. That's absolutely true. Just because the airspace over the United States is under the sovereignty of the United States doesn't mean that what we do here in America wouldn't affect someone outside our jurisdiction. What is the real goal here? And is environmentalism merely a tool in the hands of those who would like to have a utopian one-world government?
Environmentalism is primarily a tool. It's primarily used for scare tactics. For instance, this whole notion of global warming is blown way out of proportion. And what people don't know, for instance, is that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and this is the primary, quote-unquote, greenhouse gas, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now keeps the Earth approximately 33 degrees centigrade warmer than would be the case if it weren't there. That is, carbon dioxide makes life as we know it possible. I mean, we would be in a mega ice age if it weren't there. So we've had huge variations in the climate of the world, over whatever history we can retrace. And the climate changes over the past 100 years are very insignificant in comparison to what we've had in the past. I mean, let's face it, in Antarctica, they drill underneath the ice. What do they find? They find forests. Where did the oil in Iraq come from? It came from huge amounts of vegetation and animal life that lived in what's now desert. I mean, the climate of the world has been immensely different in the past than what it is today. Is there any real evidence that burning fossil fuels is causing global warming? Todd, there is none. It's total scare tactics on the part of the environmentalists, and the goal is to scare people enough so that they think, well, let's accept a world federalism, which will be a tyranny. There is no way to control a one-world government. We will all be under tyrannical control. So let's accept this radical solution when we actually can solve the problems in other ways.
Let's talk about pantheism and tolerance. What role does pantheism, give us a definition, what does it play in together with this utopianism?
Well, pantheism, very simply, is the view that everything is God. God is not separate from creation. God is one with the creation. It's probably the easiest definition. And so people are part of God, the animals are part of God, the rocks are part of God, the trees, the sea, the atmosphere, the stars, the moon, that God and nature are one and the same. Pantheism, by definition, is everything is God. So that religious view has been with us as long as the earth has stood. There is a new form of pantheism, which is part of the global federalist dream, and that is the pantheism that refers to the Earth as Mother, Mother Earth, which we then exist to serve and not the other way around. And Mother Earth is the steward of us, not the other way around. Let me just give an example or two of that. In the new Harcourt Brace reading series, there is a story about this called The People Who Hug the Trees. And I like to point this out, because people like me are sometimes accused of name-calling when we talk about other individuals as being tree-huggers. Well, anyway, this story is called The People Who Hug the Trees. And in this story, you have a woman who physically wraps herself, her body, around a tree as much as she can, and she has some small children. And the small children are told to wrap their bodies around the trees so that the loggers can't come and they can't cut the trees. And then when the loggers leave, the mother says to the kids, these trees are your brothers and your sisters. And then she talks to the trees, and the trees talk back, and this sort of thing. And so this is the notion that everything is spiritual. We're spiritual. The trees are spiritual. We're all the same. We're all brothers. We're all sisters. And this is being aggressively taught in the textbooks. It's in the tests. It's in all the mythology which the literature is now preoccupied with. I'm not opposed to teaching mythology, but there's a preoccupation with mythology, and this mythology, much of it is this earth worship pantheism. The term Gaia hypothesis or Gaia view is commonly used. That's James Lovelock's description. Gaia means the earth is God. And we are part of the earth, and we are part of God, and we're all one big happy being, divine being.
And the new notion of tolerance, where does that play into this?
The notion of tolerance is the notion that that all truth is constructed by some particular culture. And it's the notion that, for instance, white males in our country have decided what is true and what is right, and we've done it only because we want to keep ourselves in power. And so the notion of tolerance is that there is no truth, because all truth is a construct. And it's the notion then that all these truth claims are equal, and that whatever truth there is has to be dictated by somebody who is enlightened, and that somebody is going to then tell us how we should run our lives. Let me mention a couple of specific aspects of diversity, and I'm going to borrow these from a scholar from the Hudson Institute by the name of John Fonte. And the reason I'm going to quote him is because, for one thing, he's a very good scholar, but secondly, because John Fonte has been very much involved in a lot of the national standards and the national history standards and so on. And John Fonte, along with Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, were very active several years ago in trying to stop the adoption of the history standards, which are part of the radical federal curriculum. But anyway, John Fonte, in describing diversity, says that these are some of the qualities that are part of it. And he says, for instance, number one, part of the notion of diversity is that the group is more important than the individual. And I love talking to this about students, because the students, all of a sudden, their eyes open up, and I say, you want to know why you do all the group projects in high school? And by the way, as a teacher, I'm not against group projects, but there's a preoccupation with group projects today in the new education system. And they say, okay, why? It's to teach you that the group is more important than the individual, and that's part of the worldview that is being taught. So that's part of this multicultural diversity worldview. Another part of the view, according to Fonte, is that everybody is either part of an oppressor group or an oppressed group. You're either the white male that's dominating the females or the poor, or you're part of the receiving end of it. And, of course, that's a Marxist concept. What else does Fonte say? Well, what he says is that all of the dominant institutions have to be changed to adopt the values of the oppressed groups. So why do students read all the literature of all the different groups, whatever they are, and all the different countries? And why do they read all their mythology? And why do California students, why do they have to study Islam? Well, the notion is that you have to teach people in the dominant group the values of the oppressed group, and that's part of the worldview. A couple other things very quickly that Fonte says. He says you have to deconstruct national narratives. And so this is why Columbus is undermined, this is why Thomas Jefferson is undermined, this is why George Washington is ignored or undermined, is you have to attack the national heroes, the national documents, you have to get rid of this notion that there's some kind of superiority in the American government system. And then last but not least, according to Fonte, is what he calls post-national citizenship. We've talked about that before. It's the notion that we have to be world citizens, not national citizens. So all of these philosophical concepts are intertwined. The utopianism, environmentalism, pantheism, the diversity, the tolerance, the multiculturalism, they're all part of a very pervasive, remarkably consistent worldview. And it's this worldview that is now being aggressively inserted into the textbooks, the tests, the teacher certification procedures, the videos, the whole educational system in our country. And the individuals who believe in this have done a marvelous job of getting their worldview incorporated into the system. I mean, they are masters of this, and they have succeeded.
We're talking with Professor Alan Quist about utopianism, pantheism, and tolerance. He's professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. If you'd like to join our conversation, we've got about 10 minutes left with Alan, and we'd be happy to take your phone calls, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I mentioned to your screener that your guest's argument is lending credence to the premillennialists, but that's not what I was going to say, I wanted to ask, even it may sound simplistic, can a face be put on this movement or a small group of people that are behind it? Are they communists?
They're not communists in the traditional sense. That is, they're not socialists, but they're Marxists in the sense of being social Marxists. That is, they believe that we have to eliminate the division between the rich and the poor. And in the new education system, for instance, this is why everything is vocational. There's no liberal arts anymore. And it's because the advocates of it are very blunt in saying, if you've got a liberal arts track and a vocational track, you've got two classes of people. You can't have two classes of people. You can only have one class, so now everything is vocational. So it's social Marxism. But to put a face on it, Humanist Manifesto number 2 was very explicit about advocating world federalism, very aggressive in that. And you've got people like Carl Rogers, famous psychologist, B.F. Skinner, Lester Mondale, all kinds of people like that signing on. Walter Cronkite has been one of the vocal advocates of the world federalist system, and there are many, many, many others who are true believers in it.
Now, how do you respond to the comment he made before his question that you are, in pointing these things out, you are either feeding into, as I mentioned before, kind of wild conspiracy theories that do try to put a face on this, the Rockefellers or the Jews or the Illuminati, or you're feeding into unbiblical end times scenarios. Does the recognition of this globalist movement necessarily feed into these erroneous positions?
Well, insofar as the end times are concerned, what the Lord said is that many things on the earth are going to get worse as we approach the end times in terms of war, rumors of war, all kinds of strife, natural disasters. And so I think it's consistent with what the Master said about the end times. At the same time, I personally have no involvement in any kind of predictions. I personally am not involved in trying to correlate this with anything specific in the Book of Daniel or the Book of Revelation. I just think that you go out way out on a limb on that. Insofar as the conspiracy theory is concerned, it's interesting that the left has convinced the entire country that conspiracies never happen. And, when we go back to 9/11, we have a major event that obviously was the result of a conspiracy. That is, people in certain positions making a plan to try to attack a country, and they were very successful in doing it. I and my family have been reading in the book of Kings with our family devotion. It's kind of interesting how often conspiracies come up in either Judah or Israel, where different kings and some of the nation kings that attacked them were subjected to conspiracies. But of course, we know today that conspiracies never happen, right? And that people are not possess original sin, but they're perfectible, and that's why conspiracies never take place anymore. That's what we've all been convinced to believe.
And yet I think it's important, Alan, that at least you be willing to disavow what I think you probably would recognize as not only illogical, but impossible theories about how some of the very things we've been talking about are coming about. I mean, people who believe that there is a cadre of a star chamber who is coordinating all this on a global level rather than individuals operating with a similar globalist worldview, not in a coordinated fashion.
Well, the fact of the matter is there is some of both. I mean, there are a lot of committed globalists in our country, and a lot of committed globalists in the world. There are a lot of like-minded people. At the same time, I was a lawmaker, a legislator for 6 years, and I know how laws are passed. And a lot of times laws are passed by people behind the scenes who put different things in laws they've done so behind the scenes, and most other people don't see the big picture. Now, let me be very explicit about this. Back in 1994, when the new federal curriculum was put into place, there were three bills that were passed that essentially put the federal system into place. One was the Goals 2000 law. The other was the school-to-work law, and the third was the funding bill, is known as H.R. 6. Now, the Goals 2000 law repeatedly said, and I didn't count up how many times it said, but it repeatedly said that this is an optional program. States can participate if they want to, and they don't have to if they don't want to.
We've got only 1 minute here.
Okay, and so anyway, everybody went back home to the constituents saying, well, this is not a bad deal because it's all optional. Well, what the legislators didn't realize at the time is that the funding bill, a different bill, said, oh, by the way, if states don't participate, they're going to lose all their education money. And so why did all 50 states participate? By the way, George Allen of Virginia tried to hold out, and he didn't succeed. Why did all 50 states participate? It's because they would have lost their federal education money. There were people behind the scenes, the Ted Kennedys and others of the world, who planned out the whole system so that it would look like it was optional, but they could force every state in by withholding funding. That's the way politics works. I've been there. That's how it happens. Is that a conspiracy? I wouldn't call it that. Is that influential people behind the scenes planning it out, pulling it off? Yes, that happens all the time. And that is what's taking place in our world today and in our country. And it's totally consistent with what the Bible says. In fact, the Bible gives this kind of scenario over and over and over and over again. We should be prepared for it in our day.
Professor Alan Quist, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Alan Quist is professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. He will be one of the speakers speaking on this very subject at more length at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th, the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin, about 2 hours north of Minneapolis. His presentation will be entitled Indoctrination in Utopianism, Pantheism, and Tolerance. Now, I'll be there for a couple of the days of that conference, broadcasting live. The cost of the entire conference is only $229, and that includes the conference, 7 nights lodging, and 19 meals. $229. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you can find information on the seminar there, or you can call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848. My greatest concern is the religious climate, whether it be a global government, but it does seem as though the climate, whether we have a global government or not, is increasingly hostile toward Christianity. And that in the name of tolerance, everything can and must be tolerated, save Christ's exclusive claim to be the only Savior of all men from sin. So whether we're headed the direction of global government or not, that remains the most pressing concern for us all. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. David Reardon about the effects of abortion.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.